Hey, welcome back to Art Pod. I'm your host, Kate Wells. And today in Art Pod, we're going to talk about writing, how to do it, where to do it, what makes good writing, how does somebody become a writer. First off, we're going to talk with Garrison Keillor. It has been almost 40 years of A Prairie Home Companion, and Keillor is going to talk with stateside Cynthia Canty about blind luck, good stories, and how he became a writer. And then we're going to go talk with a young writer who's in Kalamazoo and is writing about why she believes Kalamazoo is a literary hub.
Welcome back to Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Cynthia Canty. You have no doubt heard that saying, life is what happens to you when you're busy making other plans. The life of my next guest could serve to illustrate the wisdom of that line. He indeed had other plans. As a romantic 20-year-old, he thought about dying young and becoming immortal like Buddy Holly or James Dean, with people leaving bouquets at his grave and mourning the loss of his enormous, complicated talent. But life happened. He didn't die tragically young, and his talent was not lost to the world. Instead, Garrison Keillor is 71 and about to mark the 40th anniversary of his radio show, A Prairie Home Companion. To celebrate this milestone, Keillor has a new book, The Keillor Reader, an anthology of his stories, essays, poems, and much more. Garrison Keillor, it's so good to have you here.
Thank you. Thank you, Cynthia.
You know, it is enlightening and, dare I say, reassuring to read your book, especially that introduction, and learn that if someone had told the 20-year-old Garrison Keillor he was going to reach millions of people through his radio show and his writing, it seems that that 20-year-old would have been pretty astounded.
I would have run in the other direction, of course. I would have taken off for some place where there are not 4 million people.
You know, it is interesting when I think of all the students I know, the new grads I've talked to, wrestling with that question, what do I do now that I'm getting out of college, and what do I do when I grow up? It seems, just from reading your introduction to The Keillor Reader, it's reassuring because life does not take us in nice straight lines, does it?
Be prepared to be lucky. This is my advice. Blind, stupid luck. Things that you never could have planned, that wouldn't have come to you had you worked your way in a straight line towards them.
And here you are with the 40th anniversary coming of A Prairie Home Companion. And it does seem that not fitting in with the rest of the kids as you were growing up, that really led you to find your gift, didn't it, of sitting at a typewriter? Well, first starting with your pencil and pad of paper.
Well, I don't know that I had a gift. People thought I did at the time because I was shy and I didn't make eye contact and I liked to, you know, sit off by myself, which is not really a sign of talent. But I had an odd talent. I think I had persistence, which is a sort of talent, and the ability to throw things away that I myself had written. The editorial urge was always strong with me. I think that's one of the hardest things for a writer to learn how to do. Is to edit yourself. You have to be able to stifle about a third of what you might otherwise do. A good instrument of self repression is handy.
The very first thing that you share with us when we open up The Keillor Reader is something that, in your words, you describe as a letter that changed my life and rescued me from despair. Tell us about that letter, and especially why it was so important that it be the first thing we read in your newest book.
I sent off four stories to the New Yorker magazine, 25 West 43rd Street, New York, New York, and they just went off in a manila envelope addressed to the editors, no cover letter or anything. And there was a young woman, I don't remember her name, she was a graduate of Bryn Mawr, and she was hired as a first reader. And she sat in a dim room looking at piles and piles of stories, sitting there in a cashmere sweater and smoking, chain smoking. And she pulled out one of my stories, and she passed it up to the editor, fiction editor, Roger Angel, and he read it and liked it, and he sent me a letter accepting a story of mine for The New Yorker, which I had been reading since I was 13. Mm. And I sat down on the doorstep of my house, and I was stunned. And I thought, well, now my life is not entirely wasted. Now something good has happened. And out of that woman whose name I can't remember, her choice of my story, came all sorts of things. And had it not been for her, I don't know what I would be doing. I'd be a rural mail carrier, a very frustrated rural mail carrier, and wondering why I never wrote a novel.
You know, looking at what is in The Keeler Reader, and it forced you to appraise your own work and to plow through 50 years of your writings to decide what should be in this anthology. How did that feel?
It felt unnatural. I don't do that as a rule. I don't sit around looking at my stuff and admiring it. I don't look at it for fear I might find a typographical error. And so I forced myself to do it. It was a job, uh-huh. And you just sit down. And I chose these pieces because I thought if somebody made me read them out loud, I would not be embarrassed. That was my criterion. And so it was interesting to take a novel. I wrote a novel called Pontoon, and it originated with a Lake Wobegon monologue on the radio show about a pontoon boat with 24 Lutheran pastors on it that sank in shallow water. And from that story, I created a novel that then, in putting together this book, I reduced back to an elaborate version of the original monologue. So it's a reconstituted story.
It's as if having clay and being able to throw it on the potter's wheel and make different things out of that same piece of clay. One of the things that you tell us about in The Keeler Reader is an assignment from the New Yorker magazine to write about the Grand Ole Opry. And for those who may never have heard of the genesis of A Prairie Home Companion, how did that lead to the radio show?
I went down to Nashville. I'd been there once before to see the Opry because I listened to it now and then up in Minnesota. In the wintertime, you could get the AM radio signal pretty well from WSM down in Nashville. I went down there to see the Opry, and it just struck me, hanging around backstage, that those people were having a wonderful time. Minnie Pearl was there, and Chet Atkins, and Roy Acuff, and Stonewall Jackson. Dolly Parton was there. She did a commercial for Beechnut Chewing Tobacco, which was really memorable. And hard to believe that she knew about chewing tobacco, but but she made us think that she did. And Porter Wagner and all of them. And it just dawned on me that I should go back to Minnesota and start a show like that, because they were just having too good a time to let them be the only ones to enjoy it.
So one more.
So I did. I started it, in innocence and ignorance, and without ignorance, where would we be?
So true. And had you even thought of yourself as a radio guy before then?
I had been a radio guy in a studio, playing classical music, and saying, and that was the Serenade for Strings in C Major by Tchaikovsky.
Oh, I can totally hear you do that.
Right, and now we turn to music of J.S. Bach. I had done that, but I had never done anything on a stage before. So it was a big step, but I was 32, and when you're 32, you're full of unreasonable confidence.
And you had evolved from that kid that couldn't look people in the eye.
You don't have to look people in the eye.
It's true.
In radio. You just look at their foreheads.
How did writing for your own radio program, basically with yourself to please and not an editor in New York, how did that affect your voice in your writing?
Well, I don't know how it affected the writing, but I knew that I had to write the show. I didn't at the beginning. It was simply a musical variety show, and I just introduced people and, you know, asked them simple questions. Mm-hmm. And but I wanted to introduce some sketch comedy, and eventually I did, and we hired actors, and that changed the show a great deal. Writing for other people's voices was a big adventure for me, and I worked hard to try and figure it out. And then early on I started telling stories about a small town, Lake Wobegon, where all the women are strong and the men are good looking and the children are above average, and that I never expected would turn into a steady line of work, but there it is. That, you know, you create your magnum opus without being aware of what you're doing.
And then all of a sudden you look and you say, wait, 40 years? How did that happen?
What? Yeah, exactly.
Garrison, we invited Michigan Radio listeners to send in some questions to ask you. We were working it in our Facebook page. So you kind of did answer this, maybe jokingly, but maybe seriously. And someone wants to know, if you had not ended up in the business of radio and writing, what other profession could you have seen yourself pursuing and enjoying?
My parents wanted me to be a teacher, but I just could not have done it. It's just much too hard, and it's exhausting work. My dad worked in the post office, and I think maybe that's where I would have gone. I've always found it sort of satisfying to file things and to put them into some order and to take a handful of mail and separate it into four different piles. I've always gotten satisfaction from it. Not embarrassed by that. And to be a rural mail carrier, I think could have been okay. Yeah. You know, you drive and you sort of sit over on the right-hand side of the car so you can, slip the bundles of mail into the boxes and your day goes by and you lead a normal life. I'm at this point sort of curious what a normal life would be like.
Well, it's funny, when I looked at the schedule, you have an intense schedule coming up to promote the Keeler Reader, so you won't be having anything normal for a while as you are all over America promoting your new book. Here's another question. What's your favorite character to play on A Prairie Home Companion?
Oh, Guy Noir. I like to be Guy Noir. I get to do just a little bit of an Eastern, slightly noirish voice, And he's somebody who I definitely am not, and so that's fun. He's not nostalgic. He's not, he's not a public radio guy. He's not a sensitive, caring American male. He's a man who's beset with failure, especially when it comes to women, and he's a great admirer of women.
Garrison, the Midwest, of course, plays such a big part in A Prairie Home Companion. It's almost literally a character on the show. What does being a Midwesterner mean to you?
I think that we are industrious people. We are secretive people. We were brought up to keep a lid on it and not to make a spectacle of ourselves. We were brought up to work to communicate by implication. We're minimalists. We're Stoics. That's kind of a cliche, but I think there's a lot of truth to it. Midwesterners travel well, I think, and I run into them when I go to Europe. I run into them out east and down south and out west, and they travel well because they don't demand recognition. They blend in well, and they're very productive people. We don't abide time wasters. We're not slackers, I think, by and large. I mean, there's a lot of individual leeway possible, but that's who I think we are. We're basically farm people, even though we've lived in cities for generations.
From where you sit and you look at this 40-year span of a Prairie Home Companion, mm-hmm. how do you think radio has changed in these 40 years and the program itself?
Well, radio seems to me to be in flight from itself, and it's trying to think of itself as a platform, as new media in a way. It's odd. What they're aiming for is kind of audio wallpaper, and either news or music, but all about format and not about the individual voice. They're afraid of the individual voice, as committees have always been, and they're leading us down the wrong path. I feel that very strongly. A Prairie Home Companion was out of step 40 years ago, and it's even more so now. And yet, there are all these people who listen to it. Why is that?
Yeah.
It's because the strongest part of radio is the individual voice. Not me, not you, but the individual voice. And when I tune on in the radio, when I'm driving around, I need some company. I turn my tuning knob in the car to find somebody who's talking to me.
The Keeler Reader, which is being released to celebrate the 40th anniversary of a Prairie Home Companion. We know you've got a big 3-day celebration coming up on July 4th, 5th, and 6th, so we'll have that to look forward to. But in the meantime, here is this wonderful anthology of your writing. And it really has been a pleasure to talk with you, Garrison Keeler. Thank you so much for joining us on Stateside.
Thank you, Cynthia.
I hear that old piano from down the avenue. I smell the popcorn, I look around for you. Oh, my sweet, sweet, sweet someone, coming through that door. It's Saturday and the band is
playing. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. What city would get your vote as one of Michigan's literary hotspots? My next guest would give her vote to Kalamazoo. Anna Clark recently wrote about the city's literary scene. Good to have you here.
I'm very glad to be here. Thank you.
So what made you decide you were going to write a story and pinpoint Kalamazoo as such a literary hotspot?
Well, the easiest answer is because it is a literary hotspot. You know, there is amazing things happening there for both writers and readers. For myself as a literary enthusiast and spending a lot of time in creative writing communities, fiction communities, poetry communities, Kalamazoo keeps coming up. And this is not just locally. I did an MFA program in Asheville, North Carolina. And, you know, folks who are thinking about going on to do a PhD in creative writing and literature would often think about Western Michigan University, which is one of the few universities that offers that. It's been a center for that I think a lot of writers do know about, but it hasn't necessarily spread beyond that. The news of it hasn't quite spread beyond that. I think a lot of Michiganders should know and get excited about
it. Yeah. So the word is spread around the nation and the writing community. So this isn't just in Michigan we think this. You're saying you're hearing this elsewhere.
Absolutely. And a lot of the folks that I talk to who are in Kalamazoo right now, many of them have deep roots in the community, but many chose to come there from elsewhere.
You talked to a woman who came from New York City,
mm-hmm.
which, you know, one might think, oh, if I'm going to make it, I'm going to make it in New York. And she grew up there and said, I'm in Kalamazoo. Why? What is it about Kalamazoo that drew her and keeps her here? And who are we talking about?
I think that one is Thisbe Nissen, mm-hmm. though she's certainly not the only New Yorker who found her way to Kalamazoo. But she is an accomplished fiction writer who made her way to Western to teach. That's when she started making her life there. And she's married to another writer who also, I think, spends her time there. And what she told me is that she was especially interested in the people of the community. You know, she felt like these were Lives Worth Telling, that people talked about things that she wanted to write about. She told me that she drew a lot of inspiration from the talent that was in the area, certainly in the writing programs. But even beyond that, she was really excited about the fact that there was such a genuine literary enthusiasm that, you know, college students are having poetry readings on their front porches. And it's just it's a really good atmosphere to be a creative person in.
So give us a sense of some of the writers who hang their hats in Kalamazoo. Certainly Bonnie Jo Campbell is a premier Michigan writer who's made quite a reputation.
Yeah, she's extraordinary. She's extraordinary, and a lot of her fiction also is very much, you know, of that place, American Salvage and Once Upon a River. You know, and she clearly draws a lot of inspiration from the area. But she is one among many names. So Stuart Dybeck is really well known for his roots in Kalamazoo. He was a real linchpin in the Western's creative writing program. And while he lives elsewhere now, he still teaches master classes there and has connections there. There's David Small, who was very much celebrated for his graphic novel, except it was nonfiction. I'm not sure what the phrase is for that. Stitches, which was a finalist for the National Book Award. He's also a Caldecott winning illustrator who collaborates a lot with his wife, Sarah Stewart. They're famous for a whole number of children's books. Thisbe Nissen, of course. There's Diane Seuss, who's a poet. There's so many, I couldn't name them all right now.
and so they've got that going on. But if you're a consumer of good writing, there's plenty in Kalamazoo.
Absolutely. There's a lot of ways you could connect to the book community as a passionate reader. So there's several independent bookstores in the area that are very much engaged. They do a lot of events. They have really knowledgeable staff to work with you and help you find the books you're going to love. There's the Friends of Poetry organization, which amplifies poetry throughout the community in a whole number of ways. There's the Kalamazoo Book Arts Center, which is very committed to the craft of books, you know, letterpress and design and things like that. They host the Edible Book Festival every year.
Great title.
Isn't it? You know, it's so fun. They do. It's a very interesting way to celebrate literary culture. So there's a whole number of things. And, of course, the writing programs at Kalamazoo College and Western have, reading series and Third Coast, the literary journal. There's books published by New Issues Press. Several bars, including Bell's Brewery, regularly host literary events. You know, so this is really, you know, a very multifaceted, multidimensional literary community. It's not like you go to one place and the whole of it is housed there. This is happening in a lot of different corners of Kalamazoo.
And as you point out in your story for the Free Press, certainly having Western Michigan University and Kalamazoo College there has helped to coalesce a lot of writers and a lot of different type of writers. But you kind of point to things in the history of Kalamazoo that help this. Talk about that.
Yeah, that was some interesting meditation that Bonnie Jo Campbell especially sort of thought about what is it of this particular area that would inspire so many writers and readers to make their home there. She suggested that, you know, in addition to the anchors of the institutions there, that there would be something about the history of it that really people draw from. And so one of that would be the fact that it has a lot of southern influences. Kalamazoo, like a lot of towns in Michigan, was the center for a migration up north. And she feels that there's a lot in common with, you know, Michigan writing, Midwestern writing, that it has a lot in common with southern writing, you know, and especially, and she said, in the way that, you know, the fiction treats their fiction treats their eccentrics, and also in their sense of place, you know, just having a really deep sense of place. She was also suggested that perhaps it something about the uncertainty of living here. Like Kalamazoo, every community in Michigan really has, you know, gone through some hard times, you know, with the recession and the auto industry and all these things. And the fact that that brings such a deep level of questioning into the lives of so many of us, that perhaps that's something that feeds into great art.
Great art doesn't come from being too comfortable.
Absolutely. You know, you got to be very alert, have a sense of wonder and a sense of open-endedness. And I think there is a lot of that in Kalamazoo.
What kind of reaction did you get from your story in the Free Press?
I was really interested in the reaction to it. There is a lot of a strong response to it. I think a lot of folks were excited to see what they already knew to be true. I think a lot of other folks, including those beyond Michigan, were very interested in being here's perhaps another place that I could live a creative life. I mean, there's a lot of talk among writers and artists about how difficult it is to do what you do best when you're, you know, spending almost all your income on rent. There's a lot of talk about how, like, you know, traditional artistic centers like New York City have been taken from us. You know, they are not a place you can live as an artist who does not have, like, substantial resources, you know. And so I think a lot of folks are very interested in alternatives to that. We've seen a lot of that in Detroit, where I make my home and where we got a lot of attention for, like, the Write a House program to give away houses to writers. And I think, you know, writers are also interested in these kind of, like, mid-sized cities like Kalamazoo, where there's a vibrant literary culture, but it's also is affordable and it provides a lot of other advantages to make sure that you can, you know, devote your resources to your art and not so much just trying to make it kind of work.
Just trying to stay afloat and keep your head above water.
It's hard. It's hard.
Writer Anna Clark, her recent piece in the Detroit Free Press entitled Kalamazoo Quietly Emerging as a Literary Hotspot. So giving respect to Kalamazoo for the kind of writers and readers that it has. Thank you so much for joining us.
I'm honored. Thank you.
All right, that's it for Art Pod today. Thank you so much for listening, and make sure to join us next time. Again, I'm your host, Kate Wells, and remember, we want to hear from you. Go ahead and leave a comment below, or go ahead and check out our website, michiganradio.org. Send us an email. Tell us what you're thinking about in terms of art in your local area. Let us know. Maybe you can catch it here next time on the podcast.
Support for arts and cultural reporting on Michigan Radio comes in part from a grant from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs and the National Endowment for the Arts.